Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. In part one, I covered the twisted tale of Walker and Peggy Raley. In part two of Murderous Ministers, you will hear about the meek minister's wife who took matters into her own hands and gunned down her husband. Okay, on to the show. Congregants gathered together to worship with their minister, Matthew Winkler, on March 22, 2006. It was nearing the start time, but Matthew, his wife Mary, and their three children had not yet arrived. Many of the attendees lost themselves in conversation and noticed it was now 7 o'clock p.m. This was not like Matthew. He was responsible and always communicated when there was even a chance there would be a change in plans. They looked around at each other, concerned. One of the elders in the church stood up and announced that he would call the family's home to check on them. Everyone nodded and felt somewhat relieved. Surely, there was an explanation for their absence. The elder walked into the church office and called the Winkler residence. The phone rang, and eventually the answering machine picked up. The elder left a message and hung up. He walked back into the sanctuary and announced that there was no answer at the Winkler homestead. They decided to wait a few more minutes. Maybe they just walked out the door. They should arrive to the church within the next 5 to 10 minutes if that was the case. When those minutes passed, the elder called again. No answer. The congregation was now worried about the family. They urged several of the elders and the church deacons to go to the Winkler home. The church office had a spare set of keys to their home, and the home was less than a few miles away from the church. When they arrived at the Winkler home, there were no lights on, and it seemed eerily quiet. They knocked on the front door, but no one came. They entered the home using their spare set of keys and walked around the darkened house, calling out for the family. Randy Smith, the church elder who led the group to the Winkler home, entered the master bedroom. As he walked further into the room, he saw something out of the corner of his eye. He turned his body to face what caught his attention. It took him several seconds to register what he was looking at. Matthew Winkler was lying on his back, the sheets and blankets that he had likely curled up in that night crumpled around his stiff body. He was still in his pajamas, which told Randy that Matthew had been in this position for several hours, maybe even a day. He called for Dr. Drew Eason, who was among the church elders searching for the Winkler family. Dr. Eason, who was searching the other side of the house, quickly ran over to the master bedroom. He saw Randy crouched down over Matthew Winkler's body. He felt for a pulse, but Matthew's heart had stopped over 12 hours before. Dr. Eason contacted 911 and informed them that there had been a murder at the home of Matthew Winkler and that his wife and three daughters were missing from the home. Selmer, Tennessee police issued an Amber Alert for Mary Winkler and the children. When detectives and police arrived, they found Matthew with blood and foam coming out of his mouth and nose. Pictures of the crime scene show a bloody spot on the bed, presumably where Matthew was sleeping before he was shot in the back. The news about the murder of Matthew Winkler, the young and enthusiastic minister, with a picture-perfect family, spread quickly through the small town of Selmer, Tennessee. Selmer is in the southwestern part of the Volunteer State. As the police arrived and secured the crime scene, a crowd gathered around the house. Many questioned the church elders about what they saw. Detectives on the scene questioned the elders about the events that led them to the Winkler house that evening. They realized that they had not seen or heard from the Winklers since Tuesday, March 21st. They told police that Matthew would have never been late to the Wednesday night service. He was the epitome of dependability. As crime scene technicians processed the scene and took photographs, they noticed the phone near Matthew's body had the phone cord removed from the receiver. The detective responsible for the case, Roger Rickman, knew he would need the aid of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations. Summer Police just didn't have the experience to take on a case of this size. They had no idea how right they were. Mary Winkler was calming her eldest daughter down while she was frantically asking about her father. A loud bang startled her awake. Confused by the sound, she went to her parents' bedroom, and she saw her father on the floor groaning, asking his wife, "Why?" She asked her mom what was wrong, and Mary quickly ushered her out of the room. She ordered her to wake up her sisters because they were leaving. Mary closed the bedroom door behind her and gathered the family in their minivan, leaving her husband to bleed to death in their shared bedroom. She was calm as she drove away towards Jackson, Mississippi. She spent the 4-hour drive fielding frantic questions from her daughter, like, "Was Daddy okay?" She answered, "Yes. Help is coming for him." She hoped that would be enough for her daughter. She couldn't wrap her mind around what just happened. They pulled into the Fairfield Inn Motel and fell asleep. They were all exhausted. When she checked her phone, she had several missed calls. She turned her phone off. She only wanted to focus on the time she had left with her daughters. The next morning, they woke up and got back on the road. She wanted to take the girls to the beach. They had never been to the beach, at least not a time they would remember. She wanted to create one last, wonderful memory with them. She told them that their daddy was in the hospital, getting the help he needed. She refused to acknowledge what really happened. She just wanted these times with her children to be happy, because what was to come was going to affect them so negatively. She was now in Orange Beach, Alabama, and 6 hours away from the crime scene she left behind. They ate breakfast at the Waffle House and then spent the rest of the morning at the beach. While the other children played, Mary looked on while holding her youngest daughter. She had flashbacks about the early years of her and Matthew's marriage. How did she end up here, sitting on a beach, watching her two eldest children playing, oblivious of their father's demise? Mary Carol Freeman was born on December 10, 1973, in Knoxville, Tennessee, to Clark and Mary Freeman. In 1975, the Freemans welcomed youngest daughter, Patricia. Her entry into the world was rife with medical problems. She suffered from cerebral palsy, encephalitis, and spinal meningitis. Mary bonded with Patricia instantly. She loved and watched over her younger sister, doing the best she could to help her mother with her care. When Mary was 13 years old, she experienced her first real loss. Her now 11-year-old sister, Patricia, passed away after suffering a heart attack during a bath. The loss was sudden and unexpected for the entire family. The Freeman family turned to their faith, the Church of Christ. They didn't believe in seeking advice or counsel outside of their church. As they mourned their loss, the Freemans were granted custody of 5 siblings they previously fostered. The news was unexpected but welcome due to their recent tragedy. Mary was known to be quite stoic. She carried herself maturely and was good-natured to her friends and family. She was just very amiable and inviting, often creating a welcoming environment for new congregants, friends, and family. Mary was very devout in her faith, so much so that when she was away at college, she would phone into the weekly Bible study her family held in their living room. In 1994, she attended Freed Hardeman University in Henderson, Tennessee. She became active in social organizations, including an evangelical forum group on campus. It was during one of those meetings that she met Matthew Winkler. She immediately noticed his athletic build, consuming charm, and good looks. Matthew Winkler was born on November 21, 1974, in Fort Worth, Texas, to Dan and Diane Winkler. To say that Matthew was born into the Church of Christ is an understatement. His grandfather, Wendell Winkler, was a well-known third-generation minister who authored several books about how to live within the Church of Christ faith. An interesting fact to note about the Church of Christ is that each church is independent of each other. They are completely autonomous from any other Church of Christ church, even if it's down the street. Realistically, each minister had complete control over how to lead his congregation. They are consistent with the belief that women are subservient to men and should not hold a leadership role within the church. When Matthew turned 5, his father graduated from seminary and began seeking jobs as a minister throughout the country. They became accustomed to moving. The family had all they needed in their church community. The children acclimated well to the change. The family settled for a time in Decatur, Alabama. The boys began to play sports and found they were exceptionally well at football. Each had a different attitude towards the sport. Matthew was the most competitive and passionate about excelling in everything he did. He graduated from Austin High School in 1993 with the title Most Popular. Matthew admired his father and wanted to carry the fourth generation of the Winkler name to the pulpit. He attended Freed Hardeman University in Henderson, Tennessee, which is where he met Mary Carol Freeman. Their courtship was rather short. It only lasted 3 months before he was visiting Clark Freeman, Mary's father, to ask for her hand in marriage. By April 1996, they were married. Their marriage wasn't the romantic whirlwind Mary was expecting. They both dropped out of college, no longer supported financially by their parents. They opted to find employment and save money. Mary felt happy initially, but when her and Matthew finally moved in together, she saw a new side to him. He was passionate, sure, but his passion sometimes turned to anger, the kind of anger that caused his face to turn red or to put his face or finger inches away from her own. She became pregnant shortly after their honeymoon and excused Matthew's behavior as stress related to the impending birth. She encouraged Matthew to continue earning his degree, which he did. Despite him being a youth minister, it was not enough to sustain his family for the long term. He returned to school to earn his degree in Bible study. In September 1997, the couple welcomed their daughter, Patricia Diane. She was named after her Aunt Patricia and paternal grandmother. Patricia was the apple of her mother's eye. She was so in love with that baby. And Mary was happy and thankful to be near her family, who could help her so that she could return to her job at the deli counter. She worked at the nearby Piggly Wiggly to help support her family while Matthew earned his degree. He graduated in 1998 and accepted a job in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mary was devastated by the change. She had never been this far from her family. Her mother was growing increasingly ill with cancer. She also found out that she and Matthew were expecting their second child. Mary's mother lost her battle to cancer in May 1999. Mary was devastated over the loss and prayed that they made their way back to their home in Tennessee. In June 1999, Matthew accepted the youth minister position at a Church of Christ in Nashville. The adopted Freeman siblings visited their sister. They shared openly that they wished they saw more of Mary, but Matthew refused their request because she was no longer their sister. She was his wife and a mother to the girls. She had responsibilities at home, responsibilities that did not include a relationship with her siblings. After Mary Alice, the couple's second daughter, was born on July 13, 1999, Mary experienced postpartum depression. She had no resources to turn to, because she believed that her faith demanded she not seek help from secular professionals. She didn't want to seek guidance from a senior minister because there might be inklings of all not being well in the Winkler home. She didn't want to do anything that would impede Matthew's career. Instead, Mary retreated into herself. The once vibrant, self-assured, and welcoming young girl was now a quiet introvert. She quietly stood by her husband as he aimed to climb the ranks in the church. The yelling and berating from Matthew didn't let up, so Mary tried to stay out of the way as much as possible. That wasn't always possible, because according to Mary, Matthew began to periodically abuse her, During a church softball game, Mary was injured when a softball hit her in the face. She didn't seek any medical attention, but it would later become necessary after Matthew kicked her in the face. He knocked a glass vase off the table when Mary bent down to pick it up. As she bent over, Matthew took the opportunity to kick her in the mouth. She couldn't live this way anymore. She wanted a divorce. Matthew told her, under no uncertain terms, would they divorce. Nothing was going to affect his ability to remain a minister in the Church of Christ. The church has a rule that ministers are not permitted to maintain their title if they divorce their spouse. Mary didn't know what to do except continue living her life with Matthew. He continued his abusive vitriol, criticizing Mary's hair, her weight, anything he could think of to hurt her. It's important to note that there are two sides to every story. Unfortunately, Matthew is no longer able to offer his accounts of these incidents. Many people who worked with him closely would corroborate Mary's statements regarding Matthew's overbearing demeanor and the condescending tone he had with her. Some co-workers overheard him telling Mary that she didn't need to eat her portion of the lunch she brought to his office. Any self-esteem she had was now depleted, and she was now subjected to wearing wigs and high-heel stilettos during sex. She protested with Matthew, saying she did not like to engage in the sexual acts he enjoyed. Matthew promised that he would not engage in those acts, but he always found a way to break that promise in the throes of passion. The wig and heels were a compromise. If Matthew promised not to have anal sex with her, she would wear what he asked. The negotiations were only to placate Mary. Matthew was going to have his way with his wife, simply because he could. Mary picked up a smoking habit to combat the nervousness she seemed to always feel when she was at home. By 2004, Mary found out that she was pregnant. Unfortunately, she suffered a miscarriage. It was a painful trauma, but Mary stifled her feelings like she had done so many times before. She was hoping things would turn around in her marriage and that she and Matthew could find their way back to the way they used to feel about each other. Finances were always tight in the Winkler household. Mary stopped working to take care of her daughters full time, and Matthew made a very small salary as a youth minister. He and Mary filled out publishers' clearinghouse sweepstake forms in the hopes that they would hit it big. Matthew had expected to be promoted to pulpit minister, but was overlooked for the promotion. He was so upset after hearing the news that he decided he would move on from that church. He was on the hunt for a new position. No more youth minister positions. This time, he was going to be in charge of his own congregation. Late in 2004, Mary found herself pregnant again. She was thrilled to be welcoming a new life into the world, but Matthew was preoccupied with the gender of the baby. Thus far, he had no boys. Mary internalized Matthew's disappointment when finding out that their youngest child was going to be a girl. She apologized to him, but despite them both having the rational sense that neither one of them could control the gender of their child, Matthew did not accept her apology. January 2005 brought a new opportunity for Matthew. He accepted a position as pulpit minister at the 4th Street Church of Christ in Selmer, Tennessee. The family picked up and moved to Selmer, and Mary settled into a routine. This pregnancy was harder than her first two, but she persevered. Matthew quickly asserted himself in the church and in the neighborhood. The Winklers acclimated to their new life quickly, and by March 2005, Mary had given birth to their third daughter, Brianna. She was born prematurely and had to be hospitalized until it was safe enough for her to come home. When Brianna finally came home, Mary had to figure out how to balance being a mother to three.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. Thank you.
Matthew's expectations for her never changed despite her depleted energy or her moods changing because of her postpartum depression. The odd thing about their relationship is that Matthew and Mary did share tender moments with each other. Some congregants noticed how the two looked at each other with love. If Mary was cold, Matthew would wrap his coat around her shoulders. Those who saw them during these good moments were shocked by the news of Matthew's death. What signs did they miss? To the others who saw Mary retreat into herself whenever Matthew entered the room, they began to understand how Matthew's death came about. One incident that was mentioned many times in media reports occurred with neighbors Sharon and David Everett. The Everetts were the proud owners of a 15-year-old Rottweiler named Molly. She was docile, friendly, and loved children. While the Everett's son was outside playing with Molly, Matthew approached. He told the child that if Molly ever entered his yard, he would shoot and kill her. Molly barked at Matthew, possibly sensing the child's fear. He walked back to his yard and resumed playing with Patricia. Sharon returned to her son, and he told his mother about Matthew's threat. She was surprised to hear a preacher had said such a thing to a child. She figured her son must have misunderstood and walked over to the Winkler house to clear it up. She told Matthew that her son was upset by his statement, but that he likely misunderstood what he said. Matthew said that no, he was very clear. If Molly entered his yard, he would shoot and kill her. She assured Matthew that Molly was protective, but that she would never purposefully attack. Matthew again reiterated his statement, and the conversation ended. She could tell during that conversation that Mary was embarrassed by Matthew's conduct that day. Incidents like this would periodically occur from 2005 until Matthew's death in 2006. The truth is, some people liked Matthew, and some didn't. The years of their marriage flashed so quickly in her mind's eye. She tried not to relive the events of the previous night, but the vivid images just raced in her head. She couldn't weave the flashbacks together enough to make sense. Part of her didn't want to remember. I mentioned earlier in the show that Matthew and Mary had experienced some financial difficulties in their marriage. Mary tried to stabilize their finances by earning her degree in education. Unfortunately for the Winklers, they fell for the Nigerian check scam and sweepstakes submissions. According to fraudguides.com, the scam works like this. You get a letter or email from someone claiming he or she has a business selling some product over the internet. A significant amount of money they need help spiriting out of their country or a charitable organization that needs to accept donations. You're told that you'll be sent a check to pay for the items you're selling, or you'll be asked to deposit money in your account, then wire them their share while you keep the rest. The key is that the deal sounds very lucrative for you, so enticing that you won't spend too much time thinking about it. And that's exactly what happened to the Winklers. Mary opened a bank account in her own name to deposit checks she received from a lottery scam they fell for. In total, she deposited $15,000, withdrew $500 of that, and tried to shift some of the money to their joint banking account. She started her first day as a substitute teacher in complete turmoil. The banks kept calling her throughout the day, accusing her of check kiting, which is a form of money laundering. Mary assured the bank that she would fix the issue, but was likely trying to find a way to tell Matthew. She didn't know what to do when the bank finally informed her that Matthew would need to be present to resolve the issue, since he was on the joint account. When Mary returned home, she listened to Matthew's rants about the church administration and their financial woes. She explained the situation at the bank, and Matthew told her that he needed to stay out of it. He was a minister and could not be associated with her bad bookkeeping. She needed to figure it out. Mary was restless the entire evening. She had done something illegal, and the issue needed a resolution quickly. Why was Matthew so difficult to talk to? Didn't he realize that if Mary got in trouble, it would be a reflection on him? She fed the kids a dinner of Pizza Hut and watched Chicken Little. After putting the kids to sleep, she spent the night tossing and turning in her bed. On April 22, 2006, she was woken up by her alarm clock, but was still in a hazy fog. She turned it off and could faintly hear baby Brianna crying in the background. She stretched some, but was met with a kick to her bottom that pushed her out of the bed. Matthew ordered her to quiet the baby. Frustrated by the disturbance and Mary's lack of speed, he got out of bed and went to Brianna's room. He placed his hand over her mouth and nose to stop her from crying. Mary rushed in the room, aware of his method of quieting the child down. He had done this with all of the kids. "Matthew, you can't do that to her. She has breathing problems." Matthew was unaffected by Mary's demands. He slammed his hand on the doorframe and went back to bed. The noise didn't startle or awake the other children. Mary changed and soothed Brianna, placing her back into the crib to fall asleep. She was still anxious from the night before, and him doing this to Brianna just sent her over the edge. He had to stop being so cruel to his own family. He never listened, and she needed to find a way to make him listen. She retrieved his shotgun from their shared closet. She unsteadily stood on top of the throw pillows that were discarded when they got into bed the night before. "Matthew, I need you to talk to me." She pointed the shotgun towards the groggy man's back. She doesn't remember how or why it happened, but the gun just went off and several pellet shots landed in Matthew's back. The force caused him to roll out of bed and onto the floor. He cried out in pain, and Mary ran over to him. She saw blood coming out of his mouth and wiped it away with the sheet that encased his body. "Why?" he struggled to ask as she crouched over him. She apologized to him, said she loved him, and that she was scared. Patricia Ann, their eldest daughter, had already walked in and heard her father's dying words. Mary's mind was now back at the beach. The memories of that morning were too hard to digest. She was giving the girls one last good day before she drove them to Dan and Diane Winkler's house. The girls would be safe there, and she could go back to Selmer to face the consequences of her actions. She gathered the children and got into the minivan. They went back to the hotel and cleaned up. They rested a while before heading out to find something to eat. As Mary was driving, she made an illegal U-turn in front of a patrol officer. The officer pulled Mary over, and she seemed calm, despite what she knew. When the officer ran her plates, he discovered that the vehicle and its occupants were the subject of an Amber Alert issued the day before. The officer asked Mary to step out of the vehicle so he could search it. That was when he discovered the shotgun in the trunk. He took Mary and the children into custody. Detectives from Tennessee drove over 6 hours to question Mary Winkler. She struggled to admit her role in the death of her husband. She first wanted to ensure that the girls were safely with Matthew's parents. When his parents arrived at the police station, they were informed that Mary was a person of interest in the death of Matthew. They couldn't believe what they were told, but they did hug Mary goodbye before leaving with the girls. Mary didn't fight extradition and agreed to return to Tennessee to face the music. Detectives kept trying to find out why Mary had shot her husband, but Mary only muttered a few sentences here and there. She did admit to her role, but could not entirely explain the events as they transpired. She mentioned Matthew's berating, but would also say she didn't want his reputation or image to be smeared by the news media. Here's a small clip of her interrogation.
"Well, we need to know why, Mary. Why'd you shoot him?"
"I love you dearly. But gosh, he could just nail me in the ground. Just took it like a mouse."
"He would knock your self-esteem down?"
Just chewing whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. I have nerve now, and I have self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And so my ugly came out. No matter what, in the end, I don't want him smeared."
When Mary arrived in Selmer, Tennessee, She had an attorney waiting for her, thanks to her cousin. His name was Steve Farese. He was a high-powered defense attorney in Mississippi. He agreed to take on Mary's case pro bono after meeting with her in the jail. He added attorney Leslie Ballin to the team, and they were ready to fight for Mary Winkler's freedom. The news media quickly descended upon the small town to find out what caused Mary Winkler to kill her husband. Reasons for Matthew's death slowly leaked out by law enforcement officials or the community at large. Gossip and rumors plagued small towns, and Selmer was no different. On March 27, 2006, Mary was arraigned and officially charged with the first-degree murder of her husband. Mary was tightly wound after the arraignment and just wanted to shut the world out for a few days. She didn't have that opportunity, as she spent the next few days visiting with her attorneys, father, and other church members. Throughout the conversations, Mary expressed her love for her husband and remorse for her actions. She feared for the day that her children would be permanently taken away from her, but maybe she deserved this. After all, she had taken their father away from them. Was this her just punishment? On March 28, 2006, America watched Matthew Winkler's friends and family lay him to rest. The media snapped pictures of his three daughters looking somber and confused. No one in attendance gave statements to the media that hounded them as they exited the church. Mary was allowed to say her final goodbye to Matthew the following day. She would spend the rest of 2006 behind bars, preparing for her trial. She received a psychological evaluation, and the psychologist determined that Mary had some mental health issues that she attempted to cover up during their session together. Eventually, Mary's diagnosis is that she suffers from PTSD and minor depression. The PTSD she suffers from likely caused episodes of disassociation, which could explain why Mary had trouble remembering exactly what happened the morning of Matthew's murder. Mary's trial was set for October 2006, but in June of 2006, her attorneys requested a bond hearing. The prosecution contested the request due to the severity of the charge as well as the possibility that Mary may harm her daughters. Their argument was that Mary had already proven she was willing to fire a weapon and carry that weapon with her while her daughters were in close proximity. Her defense countered that Mary had an opportunity to bail herself out in March, but did not, and she would never harm her daughters. Otherwise, she would have taken the opportunity when she was on the road. She also waived extradition and a preliminary hearing. This was all done in good faith to the court. On July 7, 2006, the judge in Mary's case, Judge Weber McGraw, ruled in favor of the defense and granted a $750,000 bond for Mary Winkler. She was able to post bond after a few weeks and was free until her trial began. She went to the home she shared with Matthew to retrieve some clothing and other items. It was surreal to be back where so much joy, pain, and tragedy occurred. After gathering her things, Mary went to the home of Rudy and Kathy Thompson. The Thompsons were congregants of the 4th Street Church who agreed to let Mary live with them during her bond hearing. She would grow accustomed to staying in her room and going to work at the dry cleaners she used to patron. She tried to return to her church home, but it was marred with those who welcomed her and those who openly shunned her. She reunited with her estranged siblings and began to follow a normal routine, a routine that couldn't include the girls, at least for now. All three of the children remained in the care of Matthew's parents, and Mary had not seen them in over 3 months. All three of the children remained in the care of Matthew's parents. And Mary had not seen them in over 3 months. She was nervous, but excited to have visits with them. The girls received her well, and they spent the majority of their visitation playing and talking. According to the girls, Mary had told them that she had nothing to do with their father's death. When the girls excitedly shared the news with their grandparents, they were taken aback. The Winklers knew Mary had confessed to shooting their son. Why would she say this? Soon after the visits with the girls, the Freeman family smeared Matthew's name in the press. Clark Freeman was the most vocal, supported by Mary's attorney, Steve Farese. The Winklers no longer wished for Mary to have visits with her daughters, so they requested full and immediate custody of the children. It was clear they were acting out of anger and hurt over the comments made about Matthew being controlling, abusive, and cruel to Mary. The trial that was to begin in October 2006 was postponed until February 2007. Mary celebrated the new year at a local bar. She was approached by a resident who asked if she was the woman who killed her husband. Mary jokingly said, "Yes, do you want to be next?" and made her way to the bar to smoke. The resident was shocked by the exchange and proceeded to take pictures of Mary at the bar. She is seen smoking and smiling with an open bottle of beer next to her. The bartender confirmed to the media that she had been in the bar over the past few months hanging out with friends and to celebrate her birthday. Those who supported Mary believed she was being her authentic self. The woman who had been so controlled by her husband was now living life on her own terms. Others felt that Mary murdered Matthew in cold blood and felt no remorse for what she did. If she was truly remorseful, she wouldn't be drinking and making jokes about murdering someone else. Didn't she miss her kids? She wasn't acting like it. Her trial was once again rescheduled to April 9, 2007. The prosecution offered Mary several plea bargains, which her and the defense team she had by her side refused. Her team was confident that Mary would be acquitted of any charges brought against her. The Winkler family was also preparing to sue Mary for the wrongful death of their son. They were requesting $2 million in damages. Mary then faced the Winklers in family court to contest their custody request. Mary's attorney alluded that the Winklers were keeping the children from her, which the Winklers denied. The judge in the case requested to speak to the eldest girls alone regarding their experience. When she returned to the courtroom a few weeks later, she was shocked by the amount of collusion occurring between the Winklers and the state prosecutor. Patricia revealed that her grandparents frequently discussed their mother, saying that she was bad, and often shared details of the court cases Mary was involved in. The judge ordered that both children go into counseling to deal with the emotional trauma from both sides. Despite the girls' testimony, the Winklers are granted temporary physical custody of all three children. The following week, on April 9, 2007, over a year after the death of her husband, Mary Winkler's jury selection began. By Wednesday, a jury of 12 women and 4 men were selected to decide the fate of Mary Winkler. The trial began on April 12, 2007. Mary opted to dress in conservative clothing. The media made mention of her cross necklace and the fact that she was still wearing her wedding band. Many were confused by this gesture. After everything she claimed to have been through, how could she still love this man and wear her wedding ring? Prosecutor Walt Freeland argued that Mary intentionally killed Matthew Winkler to hide the check scheme that she took a greedy part in. Instead of Mary falling victim to the scheme, she instead took the phony checks and deposited them into her account. The next step, if the person had indeed fallen victim to the scheme, would be to wire some money back to the requester. Mary never wired the money. She just deposited it in her account and withdrew money she knew was never really there. They attempted to paint Mary as a manipulative woman who masterminded the death of Matthew Winkler with cold precision to avoid having him find out that their joint account was delinquent $5,000.
Mary Winkler premeditatedly, unlawfully, and intentionally killed Matthew Winkler, a man that did not deserve to die.
The defense countered that Mary was an abused woman who was in constant fear of the man she loved.
Mary Winkler had what appeared to everyone a marriage made in heaven, but behind closed doors, it was a living hell.
She had requested a divorce, but Matthew would never allow it.
I had asked Matthew to have a divorce, and he absolutely denied it. That would not be allowed.
Now, despite all she had been through, Her children were being used against her. Further, Matthew insisted that she enter sweepstakes, and when Mary received the check, he insisted that she deposit the check into their accounts so they could take care of some bills. Each side brought various witnesses to support their respective cases. The saddest and most touching testimony came from Mary and Matthew's eldest daughter, Patricia. She was asked if her father was a good father, to which she replied that he was. She was also asked to recall what she saw the day of her father's murder. Her testimony was brief and tearful. Mary testified in her own defense, and some claims were made that shocked those in attendance. Her defense attorney handed Mary a bag and asked her to remove the contents. She pulled out the first item, a brown wig. Her attorney asked her to identify the item, which she did. The second item she pulled out was a stiletto heel, one that is often attributed as a stripper heel. Again, she was asked to identify the item.
The kind of shoe that you would wear to church?
No, sir.
Where'd you get that wig, Mary?
From Matthew.
Why was that shoe bought, Mary?
Matthew wanted me to wear it. To dress up.
Dress up for what purpose?
Sex.
She also revealed that she was forced to take pornographic photos and engage in anal sex.
He just wanted to have sex with my bottom.
Did it hurt you?
Yes, sir.
What were you told when you expressed your concern?
He said okay, but then he would do it again.
What was his answer for if it did hurt you?
They have surgery and they can fix it. It's just so bad and I just want it out.
This confirmed what was found in evidence. Matthew had hundreds of pornographic videos and photos, including those of Mary, on the home computer. Mary also recounted the instances of physical, emotional, and verbal abuse by Matthew. She did her best to recall the events leading up to Matthew's death and how he had, in her words, suffocated Brianna. She was cross-examined by the prosecutor, who attempted to dismantle all of her statements.
What did Matthew Winkler do to deserve to die?
Nothing. Nobody made that decision.
Matthew Winkler, in fact, did not deserve to die, did he?
No.
So what was it that led you into the position of accidentally shooting Matthew Winkler?
I just wanted to talk to him.
It wasn't an accident, was it?
Yes, sir.
You just wanted to talk to him and he wouldn't listen. So you shot him in the middle of the back while he was asleep. Now, has that memory come back to you, Ms. Winkler?
No, sir.
Final arguments were made on April 18, 2007, with both sides reiterating that Mary was either malicious or abused. The jury was then released to determine their verdict. 8 hours later, they informed the court that they had reached a decision. At 5:25 on April 18, 2007, Mary Winkler faced a jury who would determine her fate and if she would ever get to be a mother to her children again. The jury had the option to select first-degree murder or manslaughter.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Mary C. Winkler, guilty of voluntary manslaughter.
Mary remained stoic and did not show any signs of glee during the verdict. Matthew's family teetered between confusion and anger. The courtroom was mostly silent. Mary remained out on bond to await sentencing. She also resumed a relationship she began in February 2007 with a man named Daryl Pillow, who she met through her employers. She returned to court to face her sentencing and was sentenced to 210 days of confinement with credit for time served, and she had the option to serve 60 of those days in a psychiatric facility. When all was said and done, Mary would only have to serve less than a week in jail for the murder of her husband.
I think of Matthew every day in the guilt, and I'll always miss him and love him. There were bad times, but there were good times, and I wish I could have that good Matthew and that we could live together forever.
She was to be under court supervision until 2010. On August 15, 2007, Mary was released from county jail and resumed her life. She ended her relationship with Daryl Pillow and pursued full custody of her children. The custody battle continued until August 1, 2008, when Mary and the Winklers came to an agreement outside of the court system. Soon after, all three of the girls returned to their mother's care. She made several media appearances in the years following Matthew's death, but has remained relatively mum on the subject. I suspect that this has to do with the girls growing older. A Lifetime original movie called The Preacher's Wife, starring Rose McGowan, was released in 2011, and it's based on the Winkler family. So, what do you think? Do you believe Mary's story, or do you think she got away with murder? Share your thoughts with me in the Facebook discussion group. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Podcast. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? If you want to hear part 3 of Murderous Ministers, consider joining us on Patreon, patreon.com/tcfcpod. We would like to welcome to the club our most recent Patreon supporters, Veronica M., Allie M., Dina B., and Margo S. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check them out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content editing for this episode was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by Ches Gray, who manages Ches Gray Music. Content warning at the top of the show was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast.